If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
So the darkest point was that first night. And I remember my dad helped me get into bed. And, you know, I was in the chair and I had transfer board. And I'm just sliding myself onto the bed. And he helps me get my legs. I had these cushions that I'd place my legs to keep me in a certain position, and he helps tuck me in, essentially.
You're a 29-year-old being tucked in by your father.
Absolutely.
That's humbling.
Yeah. Remember my dad closing, he tucks me in and closes the door, and I remember just laying there. And that's, I think, the first time everything dawned on me at the same time. I thought about everything separately, but that's where everything just came together. And I just started, like, you become overwhelmed with the magnitude of what was happening. And eventually, again, just kind of started sobbing.
When you say everything came together, whatever words you use there, what is the everything?
It was, I was in a new apartment. You know, people, I remember being at St. Luke's and people saying, oh, you must be really excited to be going home. And I was like, this isn't home. You know, this is a hotel room, right? This is a apartment that looks like a hotel room that it had somebody else's furniture. It was one of these pre-furnished apartments. It wasn't my things. It didn't have any of my stuff. I had, you know, hospital pillows everywhere. You know, was simultaneously thinking about, I don't know if I'm going to run. I don't know if I'm going to ride my bike. I don't know if I'm going to be able to stand. I don't know if I can. I had no idea what my prognosis was going to be. It was just a lot of unknown. And I wanted to know, what is my life going to look like? I just want to know.
This is Guillermo Romano Ibarra.
There he is, Guillermo, the man of the hour.
How's it going?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Oh, good. You brought the whole crew.
On this particular day, back in September of 2020, I met Guillermo at Lake McBride State Park. I've known Guillermo since he joined the ICOWS, a swimming group I'm part of. ICOWS, Iowa City Open Water Swimmers.
Guillermo, we're out on the dock here.
Now, life on our planet evolved from water billions of years ago. Throughout human history, water has been ascribed healing powers. In fact, a recent scientific study shows cold water swimming may protect the brain from degenerative diseases like dementia.
Okay, this is my little digital aquarium thermometer that I've had. You get a two-pack of these on the internet for like $5. So here we are. It'll take a moment to register, like 10 seconds. Okay, it's dropping down to 69.
Water's power to heal. That's why we're here today at Lake McBride. But more on that later. Guillermo came to Eastern Iowa to be part of the University of Iowa Medical Scientist Training Program. The rigorous 7 or 8 years of study results in an MD and a PhD, if all goes well. But let's go back a few years. Guillermo was living in Seattle when he started thinking about attending medical school. Iowa attracted him for a couple of reasons. His mother attended the University of Iowa, and there was plenty of opportunity to continue an active lifestyle.
I'd heard about the ICOWS a long time ago. So I heard about the ICOWS when I was interviewing and looking at different programs.
And you'd heard about the ICOWS in Seattle?
When I interviewed here, I found out the program director was a cyclist, and I was cycling at the time. And they're like, oh, you got to talk to Steve about cycling.
Steve, Dr. Steve Lentz. He's head of the medical scientist training program at the University of Iowa.
And so he was a cyclist. So I asked him,
How much cycling is there in Iowa City in Iowa?
Guillermo says he's always gravitated to more technical sports, like swimming and cycling. Back when Guillermo lived in the Pacific Northwest, he helped coach a Paralympic swim team of disabled athletes called the Shadow Seals. He also enjoys weightlifting and running.
More trotting than running. So I was not your classic cyclist build. So most cyclists are, 130 to 160 pounds.
Right.
So when I was on my club cycling team in college, and the heaviest guy after me weighed 180 pounds, and then the next heaviest guy was 160. And so there were only three of us over 155, and I was, at the time, I was like 215, 220.
Okay, so you're in there. You're in the...
So I'm a big guy.
You get a broad frame. You carry it well.
Well, thank you. I'm dense.
When Guillermo moved to Iowa City to begin medical school, he found an apartment he fell in love with.
And it was this beautiful 19-teens building that was, brick on the outside and hardwood floors, and you had these arches inside, and it was a lot of character. There was a spiral staircase in the back, and I loved that apartment.
Soon after settling in, Guillermo rode part of Iowa's famous Ragbri bike ride across the state with some friends, and from there he began to discover more trails in the area. Cycling was becoming a refuge for Guillermo, a nice change of pace from the demanding rigor of medical school. Okay, let's talk about the day it happened, August 28th, 2019. On that day, Guillermo took his high-performance road bike in for maintenance, and right after the tune-up, he decided to set out on a ride in the country on a beautiful late summer evening. The plan was to head south from Iowa City toward the town of Lone Tree. Little did he know, when he locked his apartment door behind him, it would be the last time he would set foot in that apartment. I'm Ben Kiefer. This is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio.
I had lights and everything to be riding fully at night if I needed to be. The rear light is one of those lights you have to put out. If you have a cyclist behind you, you have to turn it off.
Yep.
So that you don't blind them and you don't annoy them.
You got some new wheels. Man, this is heaven.
It was great.
You're alone.
I'm alone. I am. And I get down to where the turnaround would be for like a 20-mile ride, and I'm having a great time, and I'm starting to, get my mind everything that's going on at work, kind of just be able to be in the moment, which I think is, why most of us end up doing these kind of activities, right?
Yeah.
And I get to Highway 22, and the Lone Tree Loop, you turn left on Highway 22 for a little over half a mile, and then you turn onto Sioux Road. And when you get onto Sioux Road, you get onto these single lane, paved country roads that nobody's on ever.
Right, with a narrow shoulder.
I don't know if you could say there's a shoulder, because there's no, it's not even painted. So those are just open roads that, you're on them and people wave at you and you wave at them and everyone's super nice. But getting to that road is the tricky part. And so I really like roads with rumble strips, because if a car starts merging towards you or getting close, you can usually hear them on the rumble strips, or you can hear them approaching. And Highway 22 does not have rumble strips, and it does not have a good shoulder. So it makes it really hard. You're trusting the drivers behind you to give you enough space and to essentially either merge or hug the middle of the highway, really. And that's where I had a friend who describes it as the fear of death watts, because you try to do it as quickly as possible.
Because?
Lots of fast-moving traffic. So So I was on that half-mile stretch of road on Highway 22 between Sands Road and Sioux Road, and I was moving, according to my GPS, about 21-ish miles an hour.
And where are you positioned on the road?
I'm on the right side of the road, right where the, essentially where the fog line would be. And that's as far as you can go without being on this really nasty gravel drop-off into the ditch, essentially. So it's basically broken pieces of concrete, broken debris from whenever it is they paved the road last. So then that's where it was starting to get dark. I remember it still being, it was dusky, I would say. And I'm on a straightaway, the sun sets behind me, so I've got the, I do that on purpose on that route. I decide which way I'm going to do it so that the sun's behind me at that stretch of road.
You're heading east.
Heading east. Mm-hmm. And then I can hear a car coming, and I see their lights on the pavement, and so I'm going to get past. And then that's it. What I remember is before everything goes black, essentially, I just remember the lights. And then suddenly what I remember is a feeling of like dizziness or nauseousness, which is me, I think, is kind of what my brain has reprogrammed into the loss of consciousness.
When you say you're aware of the car coming up behind you.
Yep.
You hear it, you see the headlights, and then you say, that's it. What does that mean, that's it?
In hindsight, that's where I got hit. The next thing I remember was being on the floor. I remember seeing some lights, some...
On the floor or the ground?
On the ground, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I remember some, red and blue lights from the emergency vehicles. And I remember them lifting me up into the ambulance, and that hurt bad enough that it kind of jolted me awake. And when I got into the ambulance, I remember starting to regain some awareness, and enough that I was able to ask what happened. There was an officer, a sheriff, and he said, you were riding your bike near Lone Tree. You got hit. And I remember him making, which seemed kind of funny to me, he was like, you had lights on. And he said something about how I was lit up, and he was surprised that I'd gotten hit given the lights that I had.
Just so we know how serious this hit was, you've showed me a photo of what one of the first responders,
yep,
one of the paramedics took of you laying by the roadside,
yep,
and your back.
Yep.
And I remember before you showed me the picture, you said, are you queasy about anything?
Yeah.
Describe that picture.
So I'm laying on my side. My bike shorts have been cut off. And so you can see my backside, and my left butt cheek looks like hamburger meat, essentially. And it looks like I've got just this, my family jokes that it kind of looked like either a shark bite or a saber-toothed tiger claw mark, and it's just torn up and gashed, and then there's kind of road rash around it. It's pretty bloody and pretty graphic.
You will soon be a doctor. So you can describe it in much more detail than I'm sure I can understand here, but what was the extent of your injuries? What happened?
When you're in medical school, when you learn to read x-rays, most of the time you're worried that you're going to miss whatever it is you're supposed to see, right? They're showing you something, and the professor saying, this is a, you know, really life-threatening fracture of the whatever, and or there's something bad about to happen. And you're squinting and looking at it, and you see this little hairline fracture. And
in a vertebrae, right?
Exactly. And it's a really big deal. And so I remember when they first, a few days later, when they're showing me the films, or it might have been the next day, they were showing me the films, and as they're scanning through the CT scan, I'm squinting, trying to pay attention because I don't want to miss it. I don't want to not see where the fracture is.
Where this hairline fracture is.
Right.
What you think will be a hairline fracture.
Exactly. And because I'm worried I'm going to miss it. And suddenly we get to one of these and I see what I think is a crack and I was like, oh, that might be it. And then the next one is just like, it looks like you let a cherry bomb in there. And it looks like somebody put something inside and popped it open. And you just have chunks of bone just floating around everywhere.
Guillermo had two fractures in his pelvis and a fractured spine. His L2 vertebra, that's at the base of the spine, was completely destroyed. However, while the one vertebra, the L2, was shattered, the rest of the vertebrae in the spine remained intact.
I would say the bar was pretty low pretty early on. You know, first it was, we're still alive. And there was, that's ice cream on top, basically, right? Like, we're still alive. Where in many other scenarios, if I hadn't been moving that fast, if I wasn't as big as I was, this would have been a manslaughter case instead of a fine.
Now, despite all of these injuries, Guillermo maintained bowel and bladder control, which, in his words, is when you start counting your blessings. And he remembers explaining this to his father.
And I remember, like, on the second or third day, I'd pulled the catheter out, and I was peeing on my own volition. And I remember just looking at him and being like, dude, I have bowel and bladder control. Like, I might not walk, but I don't have to wear a diaper the rest of my life.
And you were at that point also enough of a medical student to really grasp it. The significance of being able to, as you say, pee and poop.
Right.
That's big.
Yeah, huge. And that's one of those, I mean, it's funny, right? Like, but
out of context, yes.
Yeah. And it was one of those, you know, my dad hadn't even thought about it. He was like, you know, because he didn't know, you know, and he knew that this had been really close to being that kind of spinal cord injury.
Guillermo's rehab began shortly after surgery. So picture this, Guillermo laying in his hospital bed and his father moving his legs around for him. He would bend Guillermo's knees back and forth, move his feet. The stimulation of the muscles helped relieve some of the incredible back pain.
And then one of the things that was most challenging was sitting. And so actually just coming into an upright position that would it would make my back spasm. And so I would have these really intense spasms. And that was one of the most challenging things in my recovery, and was just even gaining the confidence to stay seated for a certain amount of time.
Guillermo was soon transferred to St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids to begin rehab in earnest. There he found himself fighting through levels of pain he had never experienced. So much pain that he didn't even want to try and sit up or move in bed because his back would start intense spasms. During one of Guillermo's first physical therapy sessions, they placed him in an electric recliner. It became a moment of excruciating pain.
And the recliner just kind of kept moving up. The recliner just kept going. And they couldn't get it to stop quickly enough. And then they couldn't get it to come back down quickly enough. So that's the worst pain that I can remember experiencing it.
And you know, when you exhibit that kind of pain, are you screaming out loud?
Oh, I was screaming and bawling. I was, you know, like, I haven't, you know, like a little kid, you bang your knee and you cry. I mean, I can't remember the last time I cried from pain, but that was one of those, like, the moment I was screaming, I guess you could hear me out, like, in the hallway, and they got me back down, and I was just sobbing. Just completely torn up, and it was just these spasms that had started in my back, and I remember saying, like, screaming, "Stop, stop, stop!" And, you know, like, yeah, trying to get them to bring me back down, and you know, everyone's trying to figure out how to do it, and yeah, and it was just, you know, one of these, my back just kind of went off on me.
What are you being told about your future?
So I remember at one point asking about that, and the prognosis they give us was, on one end, you could be a paraplegic. So half of your body, you don't have nerve signals to half of your body. And so, you know, no use of your legs, no feeling in your legs.
From the waist down, paralyzed.
From the waist down, paralyzed, yep. So it could be paraplegic because they didn't know the extent of damage or kind of how affected the spinal cord had been. And then on the other end, they said you could be totally fine neurologically, and these could just be bone fractures, like it just could be fractures. So it could be purely orthopedic, in which case you could be running another half marathon in 6 months.
Wow.
Or training for another half marathon in 6 months.
So there's a rosy outlook.
Yeah, and to me that was kind of a non-prognosis.
Why?
Well, I was kind of like, that encompasses everything, right?
It could be.
Yeah. You could never use your legs again, or you could be running a half marathon or training for a half marathon in 6 months. Once your bones heal, you could be perfectly fine, back to your normal life that you were living before, trying to run and cycle and do all that. Or you could be paraplegic and never use your legs again.
And that depended on what, according to them?
We didn't know.
After a break, Guillermo and I plunge into the lake to see how water has become critical to his rehab. Also, we'll find out whether he'll walk again and hear his thoughts on the driver who ran him over. I'm Ben Kiefer. This is a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio.
The way you get your news may have changed during this pandemic, but you still need to know what's going on in our state every day. Iowa Public Radio News has you covered. Subscribe to our new podcast, Hear First, and start your day equipped with the essential local news you need to know, delivered in under 15 minutes, weekdays by 7 a.m. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters, learn about what's going on at the Statehouse and on the ground in your community. Subscribe to Hear First today wherever you get your podcasts.
The legislative session is scheduled for 110 days. There will be hundreds of bills proposed this year.
I would like to call the subcommittee meeting to order.
From subcommittees to committees.
I really want to support this bill.
To the chamber floor.
Every senator has voted. The secretary will close the voting system.
Our weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, walks you through the legislative process. I'm John Pimple. Subscribe to Under the Golden Dome with your podcast listening program or hear it at iowapublicradio.org.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and today you're listening to a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. After spending several weeks in rehab following a horrific bike crash with a car in August of 2019, Guillermo Romano Ibarra started to adjust to his new life in recovery. He developed a community of people around him, people who were all working for the same thing, and he felt really good about the progress he was making. But Guillermo was lucky. A few centimeters difference in the point of impact, and there would have been major damage to his spinal cord. He was grateful he was on his way to walking again, but knew his recovery was going to be long, painful, and difficult, with little to no independence.
I think I'd had a really great attitude because it had been very almost like a summer camp kind of a thing. And I've talked to another guy who had a spinal cord injury. And it was funny because he said, yeah, rehab was fun. And he's like, you're trying to do new things. You've got mm-hmm. people around you who are also going through things. You've got a staff. And he's like, and I remember him telling me, did anyone warn you that the worst part was going to be going home? And I was like, no. And we were talking about this earlier, you know, it's funny, but, you know, the first time I pooped, like, you know, I'd spent, I don't know how many times I had to poop in the bed in a pan, you know, and I showered with people and I'm using my
they're
dad
they're
is
helping
tucking
you shower.
Me in. Yeah. They're helping me shower and so, independence was gone, was out the window.
Over the course of several months, Guillermo made slow progress in getting back on his feet. He started with just a few steps at a time, with the help of parallel bars, walkers, and a harness suspension system. Today, Guillermo still uses a crutch for walking, wears a back brace, and uses his wheelchair as needed. He also got a couple of dogs during his recovery. Alistair, Mad-Eye, Moody, and Tonks. Guillermo says his dogs have been great for his mental outlook. But one thing has not changed. The pain. Guillermo finds himself in constant pain, and he's in a never-ending process of figuring out how to manage that pain.
Do you have a different relationship to pain than before the crash?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do you... how is it different?
So there's this... And this is, again, one of those things that I've understood and I have the benefit of understanding from being a medical student. And, you know, we hear about back pain and we hear about the opioid crisis and how many patients out there are on opioids. And so I knew kind of pretty early on, and my mom especially was very conservative about the opioids. She was really...
don't get hooked.
She would get on me. Yeah, exactly. She was like, no, you know... but I also understood that, you know, when we say pain management, that doesn't mean getting rid of the pain. It means reducing the pain to a point where you can function, and you can do what you're trying to do. And that, it's really vague and that's really hard to do, because and that's something I still struggle with today, where it's like, well, okay, like, you know, I can stand right now, but bending and bending over is still really challenging. And so something as simple as taking dishes out of the bottom rack of a dish, you know, washer, you know, I could say, well, that hurts, right? Well, if that hurts, does that mean I shouldn't do it? Well, if I shouldn't do it, that means that my pain's not well managed. And so then if I don't do it, then my pain's not well managed. And then
I see.
And so it becomes this circular argument and to where you're trying to convince yourself, how far do you push yourself past the pain to do things?
Of course, Guillermo does a lot of physical therapy to build muscle, build endurance in walking and help with the pain. But early on in his rehab, Guillermo found one activity that changed everything for him. And that's why we met on this day at Lake McBride.
Swimming is the one exercise I can do that does not hurt while I'm doing it and that does not leave me with more pain afterwards. And I would say it actually helps my back afterwards. And that's You know, I've gone on wheelchair pushes, and I'll do a little bit of weightlifting, and I'll try doing the hand cycle, and I've been able to do a stationary bike, and those all leave me with back pain afterwards. And I'm like, part of me loves doing anything that's bike related, but part of me also knows, you know, I can do about 20 minutes of it, and then I know that I'm going to be hurting afterwards. But I can swim for an hour and feel great. And I think that's brought me back into swimming even more.
All right. What do we say? Moo-rah!
Moo-rah!
Woo!
Oh, that's nice.
Guillermo, we're here by the side of the dock, about ready to get out after about a half an hour swim. Tell me, what does this do in terms of therapy, in terms of rehab for you with your injury?
I think the single biggest thing is probably pain management. And so I've had a lot of really, so I have muscle spasms, and that's been one of the things that has kind of held me up. The managing the spasms and then the pain that causes my back. Swimming helps me kind of take care of that. And so in addition to the, you know, it helps me use muscles that I'm trying to strengthen, and it's a great way of doing that. And it helps me keep my core strength up. And so that, you know, the kicking motion can stimulate that. Pretty early on, before I was able to stand, I would do, I would practice standing in the shallow end. I would practice taking a few steps. And then I would practice lifting my legs and all of that. Eventually, when I actually started being able to swim, the flip turns were really big. I found a way of being able to flip. It was pretty different because now I've got the rods in my back, and so my back would move differently in the water. But
so some of your part of your spine is immobilized compared mm-hmm. to an able-bodied spine.
Yep. And so I've got two rods that go from where your ribs basically end down almost down to where your pelvis is almost. So I've got two levels that are mobile still. And so those will still move, but the flip turn part, when you get to the wall and you turn around, that was pretty different.
Do you remember I don't know if you read this or some rehab person told you swimming would be good, or was there a day when you got in the pool and you said, I know this is the answer, or one of the big answers?
Probably 2 months after my accident that I got into the water for the first time.
And
oh, it was amazing.
Euphoria?
Oh yeah, it was just like I could move, and I started swimming, and it was funny because everything about my movements up until that point had been totally new, right? And I still wasn't standing, I still wasn't able to put weight on my pelvis, and so everything that I'd been doing was from the wheelchair at that point. And I went from my wheelchair to that little chair that lifts you up, and they lifted me up, and then they lowered me down into the water. And when I pushed off, it was just kind of like, I mean, my right leg still felt really wonky.
Yeah.
But when my arm started moving and when I started swimming, it was
and then
familiarity.
The beautiful thing about swimming is gravity disappears.
It goes away, totally.
Gravity goes up here, and that was your full gravity.
Yep. And it was suddenly I could do things that I couldn't do before, and you know, I could move my legs in ways that I couldn't move. And then I actually started doing some pool physical therapy. So yeah, the combination of pool physical therapy and then pool swimming and then normal therapy, those were huge.
Well, I think we should get out, mainly because I'm starting to shiver.
I can hear it.
I said I don't think I've conducted a 10-minute interview in cold water before, but now I have.
See, you made the mistake. You were moving. I just sat still and warmed the water around me.
Guillermo, how close did you come to dying?
Most people, I feel like, drive 5 to 10 over the speed limit, especially on these county roads.
Yeah, we all know that.
So I would say speed limit was 55, so she was probably, we'll say, going 60. And I was moving about 20 miles an hour. So I remember being told if you hadn't been moving 20 miles an hour, this would have been the difference between a 40-mile-an-hour impact to a 60-mile-an-hour impact is quite significant. If you didn't weigh 225, 230 pounds, and you'd weighed the 130 or 150 that most cyclists do, you probably wouldn't be alive. If you didn't do the kind of weightlifting that you do, you know, the I'm not a big weightlifter by any means, but I do some strength training and, you know, deadlifting. And so my spine surgeon said that when I was impacted, my muscles around the spine basically just tightened up and held everything together. And he said, that's the reason why your spinal cord is still intact. And so if my muscles hadn't been able to do that, I'd certainly be worse off, if not dead.
The woman who hit Guillermo was traveling with a relative when she struck him near Lone Tree on Highway 22. As of April 2021, Guillermo has not spoken directly with the woman that hit him. He still has questions about what caused the crash. Two lawsuits were filed, one criminal, one civil. The criminal case was settled in July of 2020. She pled guilty to operating a vehicle too close to a bicyclist and had to pay a $65 fine plus a small criminal service surcharge and $55 of court costs. She was also sentenced to 30 days in jail, which were all waived. She was also required to complete 60 hours of community service. Guillermo asked that her community service go towards something that was bike-related, or that she help petition or lobby to have a shoulder put on the stretch of road where he was hit. But measures like this are difficult to enforce. The civil lawsuit is not scheduled to move ahead until April of 2022.
As a person, what are your thoughts about her? She didn't leave the scene of the accident.
She didn't, no. And that's, I think, huge. And I, when I got to the hospital, I got fluids and I got, I think, two blood transfusions. And I don't know that I would be here if she had left.
What did she do immediately after she hit you?
I'm not entirely sure. I have her statement to the police that she gave. And so according to her, I was trying to get back up, or I was somehow semi-conscious or trying to move, and she convinced me to not move. I guess they called 911 and they were there waiting for the ambulance to arrive.
So you don't know exactly what she did immediately after the accident,
yep.
But you are convinced that that perhaps saved your life.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
I guess by thinking about her anguish, I don't want to minimize what
Absolutely.
You've gone through. But
oh, for sure.
But you think of, I don't have you put yourself in her shoes
yeah.
and said, there have been times when I've been distracted. We don't know why
of course.
She ran over you.
Yep.
Maybe she was on a cell phone.
Yep.
Maybe she was distracted by something else.
Yep.
But have you put yourself in her shoes?
Oh, of course. And I think it must be. And this is one of those things that I've had a lot of these conversations with my mom, right? And the mama bear kind of instinct takes over. And she's like, oh, my God, this person, they, you know, and she starts kind of going off. And I'm like, you know, nobody hits a cyclist on purpose. It wasn't out of malice. I was like, you know, there's a reason rumble strips work on roads, right? Like, nobody tries to drive their car off, or nobody means to drive their car off, generally.
Right.
And we all get distracted, and we all sometimes drift a little bit. And it just so happened that when she got distracted or drifted a little bit, there was a cyclist there, you know, and luckily I was moving fast enough and I was big enough that I survived it.
And maybe you'll never get to talk with her. Maybe you will. This civil lawsuit is ongoing. What's a question or two if she was sitting as close as I am to you at this picnic table? And she said, I'm going to answer a couple of your questions. What are they?
You know, I hope she's okay.
You would tell her that.
Yeah. I remember the sentencing hearing was, I think, a little bit after John Lewis passed away.
Yeah.
And I was watching TV and they quoted John Lewis. And I guess John Lewis, at some point, there had been a, you know, during some march or some.
Yeah, the Selma March and the bridge, that he was beaten practically almost to death.
Yep. And one of the guys who beat him came into his office decades later with his son. And he was like, you know, Congressman Lewis, I was one of the men who beat you when you got off the bus. And you know, the guy starts sobbing. And John Lewis said, you know, hate is too heavy a burden for anyone to carry. And they kind of reconnected and they, I think there were tears in everybody's eyes and they hugged and they kind of moved on. And I think that's something I took to heart. I think my mom's Catholic and I remember I was like, you know, you got to believe that justice doesn't come from us, right? Like, your job is just to forgive and move on. And I think that that's really important, because otherwise I think you can just tie yourself into knots trying to figure out what's even and what's just and what's, you know. I think I was like, you know, the only thing that happens is you start feeling angry and resentful, and the only person who's suffering is you.
Tell me in concrete terms, what should happen in terms of a bike safety in this state, in any state? How can we make biking safer? What's being ignored? What are some easy fixes that we don't have in place now?
Yeah. An important step, but also in some ways a cop-out, is better laws, right? And so this idea of, is it a misdemeanor or is it a heavier crime or is it you lose your license? Or the reason that that would be important is that it raises awareness in it, and now everyone's invested, right? You know, if we had heavier punishing laws, that wouldn't have changed what happened to me, right? That would have just changed what happened afterwards. And then hopefully other people can learn from that so that other people can pay more attention. But I think the most important thing is infrastructure and trying to basically systemically make it safer to be on the road. And so I personally, what I really like myself is having the space to ride. And so for me, I love rumble strips. I love a shoulder that's protected by rumble strips, because rumble strips are statistically proven to keep drivers on the road. And those statistics come from saving drivers' lives. But if they're keeping drivers on the road and saving their lives, that they're also going to be helping the cyclists on the other side. And then the other thing would just be, if we can't have rumble strips, is having better shoulders. You give them a shoulder that takes pressure off the driver to pass them safely, and it also makes the cyclist feel good.
It's clear something needs to happen. Better laws, safer accommodations for bikers on roads and highways. According to the Iowa Bicycle Coalition, between 2018 and 2020, 35 bikers were killed by cars or trucks just in Iowa. And that's not to mention the scores of bikers, like Guillermo, who survive a crash with serious injuries and have to live with a disability. Now, in listening to Guillermo, I bet you've been asking yourself the same questions I have. What if that had happened to me? Could I handle this sort of near-death experience and the long, painful recovery? Could I find and harness the incredible resilience Guillermo showed? Well, I had a chance to speak with a friend of Guillermo's, a fellow researcher, also a medical scientist in the training program at the University of Iowa. She knew him before the crash, and she even went to the hospital to visit him right after that first emergency surgery. I told her I was amazed at his positive attitude in the face of such tremendous adversity. Was he this way before the crash? I asked. Oh, yes, she chuckled. That is Guillermo. That is who he is. Always positive. This has been a special edition of River to River, written and produced by me, Ben Kiefer, and Rick Brewer. Original sound design by Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And special thanks to Annie Chapman Brewer for her help on this story. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay safe on two wheels, in the water, on land, wherever you are.